Welcome to Issues and Ideas. This week, Marisa Waddell looks into an organization that serves the needs of homebound seniors.
That's what separates us apart from the public transit agencies. Our volunteers are able to go get the clients at their front door and help them into their car and help them in through the door of the physician's office, and they're there waiting on them when they're finished with their appointment. So that kind of reassurance provides a sense of security that's just unsurpassed.
Then our traveling Tom Wilmer visits New Mexico and introduces us to a special hotel that serves as a showcase for the work of regional artists.
We have identified four up-and-coming and established contemporary Native American artists, given them free rein at hotel guest rooms and said, go in there, transform this room into a live-in work of art.
And Chrissy Hewitt and Stephen DeLuque visit with Frank Goss, one of the owners of an outstanding gallery in Santa Barbara. But first, Marisa Waddell has a special guest.
There's an organization on the Central Coast whose mission is to provide volunteer support to seniors so they can live independently while maintaining dignity, respect, and quality of life. Their services are free, and they support seniors in the Santa Maria, Lompoc, and Santa Ynez Valleys. I'm talking about Community Partners in Caring, and my guest today is the CPC Executive Director, Ashley Payne. Welcome, Ashley.
Thank you for having me.
Ashley, you're having a fundraiser coming up this month, and we'll hear a little bit about that. But first, give me some background about the CPC, and tell me what the specific services are that you offer.
Yes, we're a volunteer agency. We have about 90 volunteers in our core that serve about 500 seniors, and we serve those seniors about 5,000 times throughout the year. And the services include door-through-door transportation to medical appointments, majority of them being, but also for shopping, any kind of service they need to go take care of outside of their home. And we also provide them with friendly visits, respite care, taking care of someone's loved one while they have a break. We also provide paperwork assistance, minor home repairs, and yard work. They're all services aimed at helping keep a senior living in their home safely.
How do seniors who need help come to your attention?
Well, we have a lot of referrals directly from medical offices. We're also on our website where people can search for us, and we have a lot of calls from children across the United States whose parents live in this area, and they find us on the web, and they want to find the services to help their parents. We're also on a lot of the social service programs on their referral lists. We get referrals from the public health department, and we also get referrals from the DMV when people lose their licenses and they're not quite ready to hop on a bus, or maybe they can't navigate around the bus system, or their appointment's not conducive to that. They're referred to our program.
So your primary service is transportation.
Yes.
Now, when you say door through door,
yes,
what does that mean?
That's what separates us apart from the public transit agencies. Our volunteers are able to go get the clients at their front door and help them into their car and help them in through the door of the physician's office, and they're there waiting on them when they're finished with their appointment. So that kind of reassurance provides a sense of security that's just unsurpassed. And so that has, over the years, kind of morphed into what we really are providing. Is about 85% of what we do is transportation.
Mm-hmm. And are you frequently communicating with people other than the seniors about schedule and things like that, or are you dealing directly with the seniors themselves?
Well, just recently we've added a new program where our clients' children or whomever that's savvy on the computer can log in and communicate with us for appointments and rides. So there's a system set up for that. And we do talk a lot with social workers, that are in home providing the personal care, which is what we don't provide. So we work a lot with social service providers and family members as well. But we talk a lot to our clients directly as well.
Mm-hmm. And I can imagine being a senior who is homebound and who doesn't have access to his or her own transportation, it can get lonely.
Yes.
So you provide the friendly visits as well. Tell me a little bit more about those.
Well, oftentimes a transportation turns into a friendly visit. So we do, you're right, that becomes a time of socialization for them that otherwise they don't have anybody to talk to. So the friendly visits are also in their home, and we try to pair them with someone that maybe has something in common. For our volunteers, we do a background and a training and a screening. So we have a pretty exhaustive application on what kind of their interests are. So we try to pair them with our clients with whom we do ask some of their hobbies as well. So hopefully they have something in common to talk about, maybe last about an hour, and provides them both with a sense of community and having involvement. And they really enjoy it, both parties, the volunteer and the client.
So you mentioned screenings for the volunteers. Tell me, what are the requirements to volunteer for Community Partners in Caring?
Well, to volunteer on your own, you have to be 18 years or older, and we do a background check, and we're just recently pulling in a DMV pull as well. And we have references, and then we do insurance verification as well for the drivers of the program. So we have an interview process that lasts probably about 30 minutes, and then we do the background screening that takes about 2 weeks to get a report back, and then you're ready to go volunteer.
And are you looking for people other than drivers? What's the kind of help that you need?
Yes, our most recent volunteer that just signed up is a handyman, so that's very helpful. We have contractors that volunteer for us, and we have Jack's Plumbing in town that donates their services pro bono, so people like that are always very helpful. Fortunately, we don't have anyone on a waiting list for our services, but we also need help with yard work. We get calls for that come the summer months with seniors that are getting complaints maybe about their homeowners association or someone in their neighborhood. They say, you need to help pull your weeds. And so we have some civic clubs that come together in the summer and some church clubs. But if there's more people that want to help with that, and we always can use more help with driving as well.
And what are the requirements to receive the services of Community Partners in Caring?
Well, our founders, when they founded the agency 15 years ago, really wanted to make it simple to qualify, so that we've continued with that. And so the age is basically how you qualify, having a need and being over 62. Majority of our clients are in their 80s. And so simply having a need, not based on your income, but we do ask your income, but we don't have to verify it. Mm-hmm. So you simply qualify based on need, because they knew that people would maybe not have the cash flow to pay for services such as ours, but maybe have an asset such as a home. So we've kept with that mission, and we're able to help people. And 99% of our clients are low income anyway. So
you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Marisa Waddell, and my guest is Ashley Payne, who's the executive director of Community Partners in Caring, which provides support to seniors in Santa Maria, Lompoc, and Santa Ynez Valleys. Tell me the story of some seniors that you've helped and how specifically you've made a difference in their lives.
Yeah, well, to quote Miss Virginia Crane, she says staying in her home without transportation is very difficult and not always available. And the purpose of these trips where she's able to go to therapy, which is very necessary for her recovery. So she's very gracious. And we also do frequent trips down to Santa Barbara, to LA, to Stanford. So we have Betty that says she doesn't want to drive the freeways anymore, and her health has been poor, and so she depends a lot on us. So those are just a few of the words from some of our clients of how much we've helped them over the years. And some of them also have said things like they don't know what they do without us. And a lot of them, their health would decline because they don't have the know-how, or maybe it's not conducive to hop on a bus.
Mm-hmm. Can you share with me any stories of the volunteers who help you? Because I think about the gratification that we receive when we give.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, we have a volunteer named Butch that I was thinking of, and we have, you know, sometimes a language barrier with our clients, but oftentimes we do have volunteers that are bilingual. But in this case, Butch, he is not bilingual, but he was still willing to take a lady that was only Spanish-speaking all the way down to Santa Barbara from Lompoc. And I just said, what did you do? What did you talk about? He said, I just turned the radio on. So that just shows you how big of a heart that Butch has to help, regardless of not being able to have a conversation. If he had to sit in quiet for an hour or so, he was willing to do that. And a lot of the volunteers have been volunteering since the beginning. There's a handful of them that have been volunteering for 15 years. So being with us for 15 years, I think, says how rewarding it is and how easy it is to fit into your daily life.
Is there a particular age range that you see that's typical for volunteers, or do you have people from all over the spectrum?
Yeah, well, we have them from all over the spectrum, but majority of them are recently retired, looking for something to do and looking for some way to give back that, you know, won't be a weekly commitment in case they do want to go on a trip somewhere, or in case they do have something personal they want to do.
You know, the services that you offer cost money. I mean, it takes a lot of money to put together an organization like this and serve so many people. Where does your funding come from?
Well, majority of it comes from grant writing. That's what I spend majority of my time doing. We write about 35 grants a year, some large, some small. And then the clients do provide some donations. We do not require it of them, but we do ask them once a year if they would like to. So we get a small portion from that. And then our annual fundraiser is where we get another large portion from. And it's really significant because that funding is then compared to how much the government will give us. If we provide a lot of local funding that we raise, then they'll match it almost 50%. So we have our annual fundraiser coming up where last year we raised about $36,000, and we have the goal of raising $40,000 this year.
Okay. And so, that fundraiser is coming up on Saturday, June 22nd at the Santa Maria Country Club.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, we have a theme, the beach theme. We're trying to do a little laid-back theme, and we have almost all of our auction items are tailored around something around the ocean. We have a trip to Hawaii, a trip to Coronado, a sailboat cruise for six couples out of Santa Barbara with dinner at sunset. We have a dinner plan with some kind of beach-themed hors d'oeuvres, a filet or a salmon entree, and a decadent chocolate raspberry lava cake. And then we have silent auction items as well, and then the live auction. We start at 5:30, and we'll probably be done about 8:30 or so.
So again, that's the fundraising dinner and auction, Saturday, June 22nd, at the Santa Maria Country Club for Community Partners in Caring. You're listening to Issues and Ideas, and I'm Marisa Waddell. We're talking with Ashley Payne, who is the Executive Director of Community Partners in Caring. A couple of years ago, you received a National Award for Excellence, and that came with some funding as well. Tell me about that.
Yes, the Beverly Foundation, which was very gracious, awarded us and recognized us as an Award of Excellence program for providing senior transportation. They really look at your cost providing the program, the cost per ride and things like that. And we were able to rank high enough across the nation to receive an award of excellence, which came with a $20,000 award. So that was huge. It was a one-time award that took our breath away. I commend them because they're the ones that helped us with that program that I mentioned, that where our clients' children can log in and schedule a ride. So they've helped us streamline our services over the last few years by funding a database for programs such as us that provide services like an array of things, not just transportation. So we can schedule these things and be more efficient, and the Beverly Foundation has been that support.
Since you have people volunteering to give people rides, and I'm assuming provide their own cars to do so, and you have some folks providing pro bono fix-it repairs and things like that, what are you spending the money that you receive on besides, say, a database?
Well, we have we do mileage reimbursement for the volunteers as well. So we would like to increase that right now, but we'd currently provide mileage reimbursement for them. And then the training for them as well, and the screening, the background checks. And then we have the staff that coordinates the services. So we operate in a very minimal budget, and we're able to provide quite a bit of services for the amount that we have to raise for the program. So that's what's one of the reasons that we stuck out to the Beverly Foundation. So other than that, we have insurance. Lots of insurance is out there to cover the program, but it helps to have a peace of mind.
How many seniors do you serve throughout Santa Maria, Lompoc, and San Ynez Valleys?
Last year we served 468 seniors, and we served those, which I think is significant to point out, about 5,600 times. So those seniors receive help from us on a monthly basis, sometimes weekly basis. So we are out there at least 5 volunteers a day, at least 5 days a week, helping seniors.
But you could always use more volunteers, right?
Yes, definitely.
And if somebody wants to volunteer or support Community Partners in Caring, how does one do that?
Well, the best number to call is our office in Santa Maria, 805-925-8000. We're there Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. But we also have our Lompoc number, 805-737-1976. And San Ynez is 805-688-1100. And we're also on the web at partnersincaring.org.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. Ashley Payne, Executive Director for Community Partners in Caring.
Thank you, Marisa.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Coming up at 2 o'clock, you'll want to stay tuned for the program On Being with Krista Tippett, who this week talks with Tammy Simon, founder of a large company devoted to publishing spiritual wisdom from a wide variety of subjects. Then at 4 o'clock, a look at the hard realities of the world of economics, finance, and business with Marketplace. Now, however, on Issues and Ideas on KCBX, we join Tom Wilmer on the road.
Nativo Lodge, situated adjacent to Interstate 25 in Albuquerque, New Mexico, is much more than just another affordable hotel. Since its inception, Heritage Hotels, with properties in Albuquerque and Santa Fe, has maintained a core mission of supporting nonprofit cultural programs and providing opportunities for the local and regional artist communities to showcase their works. An entirely new concept, just unveiled by Heritage Hotels, is the Nativo Lodge Artist Rooms, where emerging New Mexico Native American artists were invited to transform guest rooms into living works of art. Four rooms, each with exceptionally distinctive interpretations, were recently unveiled. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Come along and join me for a visit with Marisa Thompson, Heritage Hotels Marketing and Creative Director, for a visit and a walking tour of the four new Native American artist rooms.
Marisa, it's jaw-dropping walking in your front doors. Volume of space and brilliant colors.
We have a 14-foot shaman in the center of our lobby, and he often draws a crowd. We have carvings by Gregory Loimayeska, who's a really famous Native American artist. And then you're also going to get a feeling of a lodge. We definitely want artwork to be accessible.
One of the things that you do here has to do with the Native American artist.
Absolutely. Our company is really more of a cultural preservation and advancement company than we are just a hotel company.
As you know, the reason why I came to see you today has to do with four new rooms.
Well, I'm thrilled about this project. This is part of our community partnerships. We have identified four up-and-coming and established contemporary Native American artists, given them free rein at hotel guest rooms and said, go in there, transform this room into a live-in work of art. So you can rent a room and be surrounded by art. There's art in the bathrooms, there's art all over the walls, and they're very four distinctive styles, and again, it's contemporary Native American, and these are all New Mexican artists as well. We're probably going to do more rooms in the future, because this is just too cool to not continue, and it presents such a great opportunity for guests, because only if you buy a piece of art and take it home and hang it on your wall can you have this kind of intimate experience where you can see it in the changing light. What's it like in the morning? What is it like in the afternoon? What is it like in the evening? And these artists got to do it site-specific as well, so they played with the light in the rooms very much.
What I find really enchanting and fascinating is these are contemporary, up-and-coming artists. So they're taking ancient, traditional, and sacred images and putting a modern twist, like your graffiti artist. I mean, that is so cool.
Yeah, it's really how we feel art is going to survive. How do you preserve your culture and heritage to the future? Well, it's about bridging that gap between this modern society we live in and the traditional values and beliefs and heritage that these artists come from. And they're doing that in very surprising, fascinating ways.
Let's go take a look at the rooms.
We are in our first artist room. This room is titled Question Material Culture, and it's by Heidi K. Brandow. And she just graduated from IAIA in Santa Fe. This room is probably our most contemporary room of all the four artist rooms. Heidi's doing this lovely thing with folding chairs and deconstructing folding chairs. And she also uses this really lovely textural techniques on the walls where you'll see these chevrons that are raised and have a relief from the other texture of the walls.
These are almost like tiles here.
I love what she does with texture. She actually put this joint compound on the wall and created a flat surface and did paintings where she's doing this monster series on one of the walls right above the desk. You see these lovely one-eyed little monsters and just kind of happy little monsters and letters.
There's a spin-off that happens from true art rooms. It happened to you in your life in San Francisco. I imagine the hope would be the same here, that people will have an affinity for these artists and follow them and maybe even become collectors eventually?
A goal of this is to really bridge art and people. Not everybody's comfortable going to museums. Not everybody will go to art galleries or art fairs and all the little arty things, but most people will stay in a hotel. And so this is a way to kind of bring art to more people and get them interested, because you might come in here and never expect this. And also with Heidi's work, you might never expect this was Native American art, because it's so contemporary and very intellectual as well.
And the colors, everything, it is so welcoming. It's so encapsulating. What a comfortable space to hang out in.
Yeah, this is actually my young intern's favorite room. Everybody has a favorite. You know, it just has this really lovely contemporary kind of feel. And people say, you know, I could see this room being in New York or D.C. or some very large market. But no, you're right here in Albuquerque, and you get this kind of urban feeling from this room, this very modern contemporary feeling.
Okay, here we are in my favorite room.
This is Kiva by Aaron Key Nate, and it's probably the room that has the most going on of our four artist rooms. On the wall, on the main wall, you're going to see a giant Tewa water serpent named Evanyu, and she comes out of a lot of ancient mythology. You're going to see petroglyphs of Evanyu. She's actually the icon of the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center. Their logo is Evanyu. Mm-hmm. So she has a lot of roots here in New Mexico. She's giant. She's riding waves and thunder and lightning, and her waves and a lot of her design actually is more akin to a Japanese Yakuza style. Aaron pulls from just tons of different pop culture references. On the wall, you also see another figure that's actually a Cocopelli figure, but he's in a Bart Simpson pose with a spray can, with his little Converse on, and so you're just going to get this blending of old and new.
Right in front of us is another great character.
Oh, this is our buffalo dancer. It's done in the Pueblo of Pahaki style. And again, he's just really bubbly. We were joking that he's just going to burst through that wall because there's so much life and movement to him. And he's, again, done in this more pop culture style with spray paint, because Aaron's a spray paint artist.
This is spray paint at its highest art form. This is really cool.
Well, you know, street art for several years has really been up and coming, and you're starting to see it in galleries. There's the whole Banksy phenomenon that's, you know, kind of swept over the world. And so it's really our way to say, you know what, this is a valid, amazing art form. But again, this is how we are taking traditional contemporary forms and mixing them with modern mediums and ideas. And these artists are bringing this art into the future. They're making this accessible for the future.
And again, I love that melding of prehistoric and ancient ways with cutting-edge modern.
That's what Nativo is all about. And that's why when you rent these artist rooms, you can't escape from art. There's so much going on in Aaron's room. There's stuff in the bathrooms. There's some surprises everywhere. There's also a lovely print on the wall. He's also a very accomplished metalsmith.
That's really different from his graffiti art.
It's a picture of Aaron wearing a metal mask that he made that's printed on metal. And it's just an amazing kind of print. More subdued, but again, you have so much going on in this room. He didn't even want us to put a TV in here, but there is a TV in here.
Very cool. Well, let's go on. I'm excited to discover some more.
Okay, so welcome. Now we are in Hosho by Rhett Lynch. Rhett is actually our most established artist. This room is really amazing. This was the first room we did. Rhett does this wonderful technique where he takes gold foil and then he paints about 80 layers on top of it, and you get this wonderful layering effect and luminescence. Above the bed, you're going to see a wall titled Prayers. This has 175 prayer ties.
Wow. That was a lot of time.
It is a lot of time that he put into this, and each prayer tie was glued to the wall with a prayer. So you're sleeping beneath 175 prayers. The other main piece in this room is called Spirit Window. It's about ceremony, meditation, and prayer. He really wants the viewer to, you know, contemplate your connection and travel a little further beyond your comfort and remember that we're all spirits.
And then you have on the opposite wall some framed paintings that are just so dramatic, so powerful.
Well, Lightning Boy and the Medicine Hunt is a little painting, and that is actually has synthetic elk teeth on it, which, you know, is a very mythological thing that Rhett's bringing into this world. And then we have another, which is actually a print that you can actually purchase yourself, called Grass Stamp. If you go to Rhett Lynch's website, rhettlynch.com, you can go and see his new work, his old work. And I go broke when I do these projects because I bought four of his paintings this time.
In the painting to our right of the Pueblos, I understand that that was a book cover.
Yeah, it's on the cover of a book called Contemporary Native American Artists that just was published. And you can also find that on Rhett's website and our website.
That's a great painting.
Yeah, it really is. There's Nativo in the bathroom, which is a nod to our Nativo logo with the zigzags that we have in the logo, which is also very spiritually significant. And then there's also infinity. It's this lovely cathedral effect that you get this glow from these two dualistic paintings in the bathroom wall by the mirror.
Part of the project is to support artists individually.
Absolutely. You know, we are hoping that people in this room want to discover more about these artists, want to follow their career. Are they exhibiting at Indian Market in Santa Fe that you can go see and meet them?
Do we have another room to see?
One more.
All right, let's go. I think one of the most striking elements of your art rooms is that each one is so distinctively different.
Yeah, that's what the beauty of it. Each artist is very distinctively different, and each room is going to appeal to a different person. Like I said, every single room is not for everyone, but every room is for someone. And I'm really curious to see who chooses what room, why they choose to stay there, and then what is your experience after living in this room? And the artists are curious. So we want everybody to go onto our blog, newmexicotravelblog.com, and give us feedback about what it was like so everyone can see that feedback and decide what room's for them.
This room, like the last one, it's like living inside of a painting.
You're really living in a unified vision here. This is Creation at Dawn, and it's done by an artist named Nanaba Chacone, and she's also a local artist. She lives in Albuquerque. She is doing a lot with Swaya as well, and this room just has a sense of beauty and lovely to it. It's the merging of the male and the female through a lot of different symbology with the chief's rug as well as blue jays, and you're going to see a giant portrait of a woman who's releasing these blue jays.
Behind you, there's sparklies.
Yeah, well, Nanaba really wanted a unified presence to this room, so she does a lovely gradient blue, which really represents twilight. So you have dawn on one side and twilight and night on the other.
You know what's really cool? There are all these bluebirds on the wall. Turn around, look out the window. Look, I'm right there, right in front of you.
Oh my goodness, there's a bird perched right now on the railing. This is on our fifth floor, and there are so many birds here. And Nanaba even noticed this when she was creating the room. We have a lovely tree outside. So each of the rooms, you know, has a unique feeling. And the artists, they're amazing because they really put their heart and soul into this. This is really them blessing the world with a piece of themselves. And so we're just blessed to make this opportunity available to guests.
From what I understand, the premium to stay in one of the art rooms is not that great at all.
It's an upgrade, the same you would pay to stay in one of our suites. Again, being accessible is a big piece of this for us. We really want this to be a bridge to bring art to more people, because art heals you. Art does amazing things, and people like you and I, who probably surround ourselves with art, know this, but we want others to be able to discover this too. Hopefully, we're going to start doing more. And
That's great.
The first four, and you know, this is just being released into the world now. We're waiting to see the response, but we think it is too special to stop. So just keep up with us on our blog and our website, nativolodge.com, and wait and see what's to come.
Marissa, thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you so much, Tom.
My pleasure. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Coming up at 3 o'clock this afternoon, it's Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Ears on Art is sponsored by Marshall's Jewelers, creating and selling fine jewelry since 1889. You can visit them on the corner of Higuera and Garden Streets in downtown San Luis Obispo.
Just off of State Street in Santa Barbara and across Anapamu from the Santa Barbara Museum of Art is a glorious little art gallery that just happens to have a fantastic cafe attached. Stay tuned. Good afternoon. You are listening to the Ears on Art segment of Issues and Ideas, broadcast from the studios of listener-supported public radio KCBX, serving Southern Monterey, San Luis Obispo, and Santa Barbara counties on the California Central Coast. Last week, I had the opportunity to drive down to Santa Barbara to visit an incredible gallery located just off of State Street on Anapamu. The Sullivan Goss Gallery is not only an amazing collection of artworks, but also has a remarkable bistro cafe attached to it. But the best part is owner Frank Goss and his fathomless knowledge of the artists and art movements of the Santa Barbara area from the late 1800s to the present. But let's let him tell the story. I am in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara on a glorious afternoon, and we are just east of State Street on Anapamu, and I'm at the Sullivan Goss Gallery, and I'm here with Frank Goss. Good afternoon.
Stephen, thank you, and it's very nice to be here today, and I appreciate you making the long drive from San Luis, but it's especially nice to have you in Santa Barbara.
Well, thank you very much. Give me a little history of the gallery. When you got started, what was the motivation?
Good question. The gallery is called Sullivan Goss, and there are two people involved, Sullivan and Goss. I am the Goss of Sullivan Goss, and my wife is the Sullivan of Sullivan Goss. And she started the gallery all by herself right after we got married 30 years ago. And the business is in its 29th and a half year. And we had a first of two children. And she was a home mother. And just talking to our baby all day long got to be a little bit boring. And so she said, you know, what do I do? It's driving me nuts. And I love my baby, but I've got to have an adult conversation from now on, time to time. And she opened the gallery in a very small commercial space in downtown Sierra Madre, which is next to Pasadena. And we operated out of that for 9 years. And then the Whittier quake of 92 occurred, and the building tilted. It was a brick building, and it tipped, and so we closed the business. We didn't have a choice. The police, the fire department closed us, but we rescued all of the inventory out of that, and we then took a couple of years to find this building where we are in Santa Barbara. And I had been an engineer. I had a engineering firm, a large engineering, 450 people, and we responded to environmental disasters around the world. So I had been involved in that, and on weekends I would sit for my wife in the gallery, and there were never sirens, and there was never anybody yelling at me, and there was never loss of life as a problem, and nobody was upset by my work product, because you just sold them a painting or a watercolor, and if they didn't like it, they could bring it back. But in the environmental world, lives were lost, and millions and sometimes billions of dollars were in the swing, and there were always people shouting because it meant the end of their businesses or careers or whatever. And so I was only too happy to join my wife. And I joined her 17 years ago and have been retired from the engineering business ever since. And we have a lovely life. She has since retired, but we are now in our 30th year of marriage, and we're just about to cross into the 30th year of the business.
Terrific. And you carry an incredible collection of artwork here. I mean, these are names. Was it always so? Did you do that down in Sierra Madre?
When we first started the business, it was a much more small business. The business name was Sullivan Goss Books and Prints, and we sold books on the art of making prints, and we sold prints, but we sold Thomas Hart Benton and Grant Wood and all of the great Bellows and all of the great printmakers, primarily the WAPA period. And over time, it got harder and harder to find those. The people that collected them didn't want to sell them, and the people that that would have been new collectors never really matured because there was nothing on the market. Young collectors couldn't be encouraged to get in. And oddly, it kind of outsold itself. Eventually, those prints that were $2,000 became $1,500 prints, and today are sometimes $1,000 prints. And so very sadly, because there wasn't inventory, the rule of supply and demand usually means if there's less supply, you get higher demand, but not in the case of American prints. And so gradually, we converted over to an art gallery that featured paintings. We have been that way now for the better part of 20 years.
I understand also that you're one of the experts on the early Santa Barbara artists that were in the 20s and 30s and that time period.
When we first came here, there was an art dealer whose name was Gary Breitweiser, and another one whose name is Jim Vitanza, and a third one, Robert Livernois, and I sort of learned at their knee. When I opened up in town, I really didn't know anything about Santa Barbara art, except if they became national artists like Ed Boreen and Remington and a few of the artists who came through here over the years that were of a national caliber. But I didn't know anything about the local artists, and I have learned that since. In some cases, I have written articles and books. By virtue of default, Robert Livernois is deceased, Jim Vitanza is deceased, and Gary Breitweiser is still kind of in the game, but not as he once was. It's actually sort of hard to find him anymore and buy and sell things to him. So in a sort of by default, I became ultimately a reservoir of some knowledge about the Santa Barbara community and its history, and ultimately fairly deep knowledge. I am an inveterate researcher and writer, and I just love it when I'm home for a weekend and get to write an article or get to learn more about some particular artist that I find interesting. And that world is just exploding, the world of research. What was available in the Reader's Guide to Periodical 20 years ago is a small fraction of what's available on Google today.
Could you give us a brief history of the arts movements in Santa Barbara?
It would parallel the kind of American art. The first artists in this area would be Native Americans, and they contributed in a way that isn't always recognized. They contributed in pictographs and cave work and sometimes carving in stone and on stone. And ultimately, they got employed, if that's the right word, in the construction and decoration of the missions in California, and certainly the mission Santa Barbara. And so, in a sort of odd way, they have a real part in California history, the history of art in California. But they gave way to the early settlers in San Francisco and Los Angeles, and oddly, in the 1860s, Santa Barbara was a bigger city than Los Angeles, and wealth came here, early wealth, in part from Spain and in part from the early kinds of businesses that cropped up in California. And in those years, is fairly much herding, ranching, and ultimately it led to citrus, and citrus led to oil, and oil led to the film industry, and the film industry led to the sort of modern age. But we can sort of tie that to art as it developed. In the very early years, there were self-taught artists and artists that were trained in the East, and they came to the West. And in Santa Barbara, the first professional artist was Henry Chapman Ford, who arrives here in the 1870s, which is pretty early. I mean, the Gold Rush is 49, and he comes out here in the early 1870s and settles here. And he's the first professional artist to put out his shingle, as it were. He opens a studio here, and he begins painting. And he trains other artists, including Mary Stevens Fish, who would be probably the first female professional artist in California, let alone in Santa Barbara. And she ultimately hangs out her shingle not in Santa Barbara, but in Los Angeles. And this is sort of the first kind of inkling of great art that will come to Santa Barbara. And they're followed by Alexander Harmer and a crew of people who are painting in a realistic style and who are judged by the, let's say, the canter of a horse. Does it look natural, and does the horse look like the breed it's supposed to look like? And in those days, any form of abstraction would have been just laughed at, and it would have been run out of town, as it were. But ultimately, we see the realists turn into the Hudson River School, the influence of the Hudson River School. And in California, there are lots of artists, but in Santa Barbara specifically, those artists come to found the Santa Barbara School of Art and Design. And they are joined up with the first Impressionists that come to Santa Barbara, and amongst those would be Colin Campbell Cooper. But the tail end of the Hudson River School would be represented by, amongst others, Lockwood DeForest. And DeForest comes here, we think, in 01, but he's trained by Frederick Church, who would be right dead center in the school of Hudson River, in the second generation of Hudson River artists, one of the greatest artists in the history of America. He teaches, his nephew is Lockwood DeForest, Church's nephew is Lockwood DeForest. DeForest comes here, Colin Campbell Cooper comes here, and a whole slew of artists, including Fernand Lundgren and lots of others, come, and Santa Barbara becomes an art colony by, let's say, 1909 or 1910, and it affects the whole coast as people come and settle in Santa Barbara. Like always, artists are moving to make a living, and so they live in the surrounding communities rather than maybe in downtown Santa Barbara, because land is a little less expensive in Carpinteria and Goleta and points north and points south before you get to the big cities. And eventually, those artists give way to the Great Impressionists, and that would be the most popular movement in art in American history. And there are lots of Impressionists that come that live here. And Santa Barbara is a rollicking community of great painters at the time. This is 1915, 1920. And the School of Art is very, very busy, and lots of great artists come out to participate. Amongst the good Impressionists that come, I don't know that we're aware that Childe Hassam ever came to Santa Barbara. We are aware that Edward Potthast came to Santa Barbara, and Potthast would be one of the most desirable and sought-after American Impressionists, both in his own day, where he was successful, and today pay millions of dollars for a good Potthast painting. So the Impressionist movement comes. Eventually, that gives way to the Deco phase of things, and there are a whole slew of good artists in Santa Barbara who are part of that movement, and that gives way to modernism to abstraction, and abstraction to contemporary art. So that's sort of in a nutshell the history of art in Santa Barbara.
If you have just joined us, you are listening to the Ears on Art segment of Issues and Ideas, produced here at the studios of listener-supported public radio KCBX in San Luis Obispo, California. Today's guest is Frank Goss, proprietor of the Sullivan Goss Gallery on Annapamoose Street, just off of State Street in downtown Santa Barbara. Could you also explain a little bit about the philosophy of your gallery? There's a little bit of that on your website, but I'd like you to expound on that if you could.
There are very few galleries in the United States that hold inventory. In general, when a gallery opens up, the gallery owner calls his friends who are an artist, and they say, Louis, you want to come in and show your art next month? And at the end of the month, Louis goes out, and Martha comes in, and at the end of the next month, Martha goes out, and Sabrina comes in at the end, and so it goes on and on and on. And so contemporary artists showing their work show one after another, but the gallery doesn't hold a lot of Sabrina's work on into the future. And when we started this gallery, I was influenced by a fellow whose name was Jake Zeitlin. Jake was an old man when I met him, and he had his gallery and bookstore on La Cienega in Los Angeles, and he represented artists. He represented great artists. And I thought, well, how do you do that? And so when my wife and I opened the gallery, we have always thought that we would rather hold 10 or 12 artists close to our sort of interests, and that we would pick the artists that we thought were the most superior artists that we could find, and that we would cultivate their careers. We would work with them, establishing their career, not on the artistic side. We certainly don't get in the least involved in suggesting to an artist that to paint bigger or smaller or red or blue or whatever is in the season that year. We let artists kind of explore their inner sort of abilities, and so we currently represent, I think, 10 artists, And I always joke when, because we get probably two or three artists a day that come in and say, you know, we'd like to show here. We're very good. And we always say, you know, that's great. We represent 10 artists, and as soon as one of them dies, we'll come talk to you. And they take some levity, and they say, oh, well, I guess I could just die, and then you could represent me. And they don't quite get the point [S2] Right. [S1] of that analogy. But we are constantly showing those same 10 artists, and we show their work about every 30 months in a cycle. And that gives artists, first of all, a period of time in which to assemble a really cogent, worthy, concentrated body of work. And so we would hope to show between 10 and maybe 25 paintings every 30 months for the artists. And that allows us to do publications, it allows us to do promotions, it allows us to establish collectors. And that's how artists survive, is that the dealer recruits and attracts and works hard at building a body of human beings who are interested in the work of a single artist and who follow that artist's career through dark times and good times. Not artists. The field of art is not a straight line. You don't start being sort of okay and get better in a straight line. You start, and hopefully the work is okay, and then you get better, and then you try something new, and that doesn't work out. And so we have to stay with artists through those periods. And so if we have a show that doesn't do well, we don't think less of the artist. We think, you know, that's an evolutionary period that they're in, and we need to stick with them through that, so that we see what the product of the lessons they're learning is. And in addition to that, then we represent the estates of artists of days gone by. Right now we have a body of work by Andrew Wyeth on the wall, and he's one of America's great treasures. And we always try to have three or four good exhibits so that when people come here, they can get a sense of the greatness of America as expressed through its artists. And right now we have... in addition to Wyeth, and Wyeth's work was done from the late 30s through the 80s, but in our other gallery, we have a show of watercolors done of the missions of California. None of them were done after 1899. So to see the missions in watercolor as they existed before the turn of the century, 100 and some years ago, is a real treat. I mean, this is when California was silent, when there were no roads, there were no automobiles. If you wanted to travel and see the missions, you did it on mule and horseback. At best, you had a buckboard. But most of these missions were off the beaten paths, and so you get to see the valley that the mission was in and the source of water that the mission had and how the missions existed in 1900, and most of them were abandoned at that time. And so it's a real treasure to see things like that. So we always try to have things from the 1900s. We always try to have a few things from the 1800s. And then we often have shows of contemporary artists. So the gallery holds in its inventory about 2,000 paintings and 2,000 works on paper. And you would have to go to New York City to find a gallery with that kind of inventory of American art. There actually is a very fine gallery in Santa Fe called the Gerald Peters Gallery. And that's the only other gallery that I can think of that's west of the Mississippi that where you could go and look at 4,000 works in an afternoon. So our philosophy is very much different from the rotate 'em in, rotate 'em out tradition of American galleries.
I discovered that the very first time I came to your gallery, which was about, I think, 4 or 5 years ago, I stumbled in. And I could tell immediately that this was not your typical rotational gallery display, because there were the historical factors that were involved, the explanations that were involved with it, and the fact that you owned a lot of the work right. that was on the walls, and that is phenomenally unusual in this day and age.
Stephen, I know you are both a reporter and an artist, and so what you as an artist are not going to know, because you have the talent, is that most people actually can't talk about artwork. And the phrase that we hear over and over and over again, probably twice a week, is, I know what I like, I just can't say it. And that's a kind of American burden. We don't teach the diction of art, and we don't teach people how to express the ideas that they have about art and even what they might like and not like. What we are hoping to do is that long vision of art that when maybe you come in when you're 30 and you see the first sort of example of art and you think, well, I really hate that, but I like this one over here. And the next time you come and you say, you know, I like that one over there. Or, what was that artist's name? And the addiction begins. And we both, through didactics that we put on the wall in the gallery to kind of help people understand things, everybody that's here is a really serious background in art history. So they can place paintings in context. They don't just say, oh, he's a San Francisco artist. They say, oh, he was in San Francisco in 1905, just before the earthquake, and these things were done at that time. And then he happened to move them across the bay to his warehouse, and then the earthquake and fire came, and he lost everything that was downtown, as did all artists, other artists that were in the San Francisco Bay Area. And all of a sudden, things that survived the earthquake start to become really important, because you realize that 99% of the art inventory that was in San Francisco was destroyed, and these few things that by accident leaked out, and the careers of artists who were, in some case, emerging artists, in some case, mid-career, in some cases, were in the full flower of their lives as artists, ended in a moment. I mean, a little shake and a week-long fire, and their careers were over. It's like, well, where? And a lot of those artists came to Santa Barbara to have the rest of their lives. First of all, because Santa Barbara is every bit as beautiful as San Francisco. But there was a sort of surety here. The only earthquake that was big was the 1925 earthquake. The fault line runs right down the main street of Santa Barbara, which is called State Street, and it destroyed the buildings about a half a block either side of State Street, and it was rebuilt in the Spanish style. It wasn't Spanish style before that. So as a consequence, Santa Barbara has a kind of unique architectural unity, which is the subject matter of lots and lots of paintings. It kind of has an odd effect on artists of, in some ways, controlling the art images that go out of Santa Barbara, because people who come into town like to leave with a painting under their arm that's of the Spanish missions or the Spanish tiles or the arches or things that are part of the Spanish Revival architecture of the post-earthquake period. They're artists that had 50 and 60-year careers. All 60 years weren't good, and all 60 years weren't productive. Ray Strong would be a good example of an artist who painted up in your area and painted here in Santa Barbara and was a great teacher. And he lived to the age of 101. He died about 6 or so years ago. And there are times when Ray was one of the best painters in America. And that was very few times, but he had that ability. And when time and tide and talent and materials and his own vision came together, there are moments when he was one of the most gifted artists in America. And then there are other times he's just knocking them out. And it's really evident that he could do both, that he could paint in a way that was positively brilliant and almost breathtaking. And then there are other times when it's almost hard to believe it was the same artist. Imagine a 60-year career, just how much your eyes change in that period, how much physical control of your hand changes when we're young and so you can do surgery without so much as a magnifying glass. That changes when we're 60 and 70. When we're 80, all of a sudden the tremble that enters our hand becomes part of the artwork. And in some cases, it makes for better artwork. And in other cases, it's a true tragedy, because Thomas Moran, who spent the tail end of his life here, clearly lost it as he got older and lost the gift of painting in the way that his famous Grand Canyon paintings or his Yosemite paintings or his Yellowstone paintings, which are amongst the greatest landscape pieces ever done in America. By the time he got here, he was an old man. That 3-foot-long brush that he used all of a sudden became a burden. Mm-hmm. And clearly he flagged when he did paintings.
Thank you for mentioning that, because I think a lot of the public doesn't understand that artists don't always have the answers. Everybody thinks that an artist walks up to a canvas or a piece of paper and they put down this image and they work through it and then it's done and they move on. And there are periods, I think, in every artist's career where you go through incredible dry spells, and it could be a lack of inspiration, it could be a lack of motivation, it could be just a frustration generally within your life that you just can't overcome.
I think that's a really good definition, because when I see the world, I'm no artist at all. I don't have any talent. I love to draw, and they're really awful drawings. And it tells me the difference between the gift that I have and the gift that a real artist has. And I watch them go through anguish, and I watch them go through difficulties in their lives, the loss of a mate, the loss of an important patron, an accident that leaves deformity. Those are all parts of artists' lives. And I look at artists, and I watch what they deliver, and I think, where did you go to get that vision? Because I'm here. We're on the same planet. We walk the same streets. We go to the same parks. We watch the same ocean. We have the same trees to gaze at. But what comes out of the artist's hand is different than what comes out of my hand. And I've often thought that in some ways, when an artist is successful at that and they get paid for their work, that in a way they're kind of like explorers. And they go into whatever part of their psyche and their talent and their emotion that delivers canvases to them, but they go into those parts of the world and they see that vision, and it's clearly their vision. The world doesn't look like that to me. And they come back and they say, here's a painting I did. But in fact, what they're saying is, here's a vision. I went into that nether world, that part that you don't get to go to, that's private and emotional and tactile and in some cases unbelievably emotional, and they come back with a report. And the report is the painting or the watercolor or the drawing. And to those of us who don't have the skill, it sometimes brings us to tears. It sometimes brings us joy. A painting that connects with a patron like myself is just one of the great gifts of life.
I had a friend of mine one time. She explained that an artwork is a postcard from a particular time and place and emotional stance of an artist. And they all change constantly.
My wife and I have been collecting art for, we've been married for 30 years, and I collected maybe 10 years before we got married, so in my case, 40, 45 years. One of the paintings that I took home maybe 30 years ago was a painting of a young black woman, done, a pretty black woman in a pink dress, and it was done probably in the late 20s, and the artist's name is Grace Vollmer. And in the late 20s, to have really powerful paintings done of another woman by a woman, it's kind of unusual. That occurred to me because that somehow tells me a little bit about the courage of Grace Vollmer. But for a white woman to be painting a black woman elegantly in 29, that has some substance all by itself. But much more important is the first time I took the painting home and I stuck it on the wall with a nail and I passed by her the following morning, I thought, oh, she's just so unbelievably beautiful, and her shoulders are back and her features are gorgeous, and her cheeks are just sort of something you want to reach out and pet. And she's got a lovely figure, and she's everything that young women can be in a kind of way that they carry forward the race. They're procreative, and they're the future of our species. And then I remember about 5 or 6 months later, I came home and had an absolutely terrible day. Everything had gone wrong for me all day long, and I forgot to fill a car up with gas. So when I arrived home, I realized I was going to have to go get gas before I took my car back downtown. And I thought, what a dummy. And I go in and I look at that painting, and her shoulders are hunched and her head is down and her eyes aren't looking at me. And all of a sudden, the issue of her being black seems like more burden than any human being ought to have to carry. And it's just crushingly sad. And I thought, well, wait a minute, this is the same painting that I thought was about proud female beauty. And so I think when artists go through those moments, but I think we go through those moments, and I think when we're listening closely to the heartbeat of ourselves as viewers and certainly as artists, things change. And we see different visions because we're older. We've got a new part of our lives to compare to that.
I have been having a conversation with Frank Goss, proprietor of the Sullivan Goss Gallery and Bistro, located at 7 East Annapamoose Street, just off of State Street in downtown Santa Barbara. The website can be found at www.sullivangoss.com, where information on artists and exhibits can be found. I am Stephen DeLuque, and you have been listening to the Ears on Art segment of Issues and Ideas, produced at the studios of listener-supported public radio KCBX. For co-host Krista Hewitt, thanks for tuning in.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas, heard every Wednesday afternoon from 1 to 2 o'clock on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Larry Rutter.